Look, I think even chickens are remarkably intelligent.
For animals with no brain.
Well, call it, I don't care how you want to put it into words, but we have this pet chicken at home. We've got six of them, but one of them can fly.
Am I the only person in Coffs Harbour without chickens?
I'm afraid so, Matthew.
I am.
We've been meaning to break it to you for some time.
Everybody's got chickens but me. You've got chickens, Cameron's got chickens, Rodney's got chickens, Peter Van Schellebeck's got chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's got chickens. I did have a chicken once.
That was a rooster, Matthew.
Well,
it didn't lay an egg.
Don't spoil the punchline. I have to tell Rodney this story because okay. He's the only person in Coffs Harbour who hasn't heard it. We had a stray chicken turn up in our front yard.
What colour was it?
It was white. And
not yours, Rodney. It's okay.
it turned up, and so we did what anybody else would do. It was only small, but it was not a chick. It was a. It had white plumage, and so we plastered the street with signs saying, "Has anybody lost a chicken? Call this number." Nobody called, and I tried making friends with it, but then they're not affectionate creatures, or at least this one wasn't.
Oh, they are.
I was feeding it muesli and bread and bits of and
they're
vegetable
they're not the
scraps
same
as
cats.
And
No.
But so. It just ran loose in the front yard and nested in the neighbour's hedge.
Emrys loved it.
Whenever I gave someone directions to our house, they would say, "Oh, you live in the chicken house," and it was fine. It was no hassle. It wasn't particularly friendly, and I was disappointed because I like to think that I can make friends with any animal, sort of. Like a character in a Disney cartoon. But one morning, the morning of the Chili Festival in about 2008 or so, mm-hmm. I had promised to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to, you know, direct traffic or whatever the hell it was. And unusually for me, I'd had a bit to drink the night before.
It's very unusual for you, Matthew.
Yeah, and I had a rotten hangover, and I would not have woken up except for the fact that chicken, in inverted commas, chose that morning to start going...
Yeah, perhaps we've all got rooster stories. Yeah, the only animal which have yet to surprise me with their intelligence is the garden worm. I haven't yet seen a worm do anything truly spectacular. But
well, there's a challenge for us all, then. Yeah. I'll be keeping an eye out for any
garden worm
doing interesting antics.
Which does something, yes.
We'll get a video.
Out of the ordinary, yes.
Yes, I'm consistently being outsmarted by one of my cats. I'm ashamed to say that on Wednesday, Ruben knows on Wednesday I have my young protege, Peter, known to the internet as BW Panda, come in to do some work with us. So normally he comes in, well, often he knocks on the door and I'm woken up by it. On a good week I'll be up and I'll have finished breakfast, but this week I was up and I'd half finished breakfast of leftover pizza. And so I had some leftover pizza.
You have a seedy life.
I had some leftover pizza sitting under the grill as my second course.
You have a seedy life.
Yes.
Did I say that? Sorry.
You know, I'm not proud of it, but pizza's very nourishing.
I had cold pizza for lunch today, actually.
But I thought, well, okay, Peter's here. I'm not going to embarrass him and me any further by continuing to eat breakfast after he's been up for a couple of hours and made his way in from Coffs Harbour. So I thought, that'll do for lunch. And halfway through the morning, I got up and went into the kitchen, and there was two pizza crusts lying in the middle of the kitchen floor, because Jackie had jumped up onto the stove and then got his arm under the griller and yanked out the couple of bits of pizza.
He didn't turn and grill it for
the first. No, he didn't cook it. He had a cold. I don't know if that's just personal preference or if he's yet to get that advanced, but...
Well done, you've been outsmarted by a cat.
Again. Yeah. Again.
Again. Well, you could probably start a little, you know, outsmarted by a cat blog here and update it, what, once an hour? Once a week? I'm not sure. Depending on how you're going.
It's not looking good. He's doing pretty well.
No, cats are great, aren't they? I quite like cats, despite their hobbies for eating precious native Australian wildlife.
Oh, well, the trick to that is to get them fat enough that they can't catch anything. Pizza helps.
Bring the piano around. Chuck it in the back of your Suzuki out. With your electric guitar, you should just always play that guitar. It sounds great.
I think it cost all of $50 when I was 8 years old.
We haven't grown out of it yet.
A friend of mine and I, who since went on to actually achieve some success in the music industry, when we were like 9 years old, used to sit in the school playground and sing Beatles songs.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Happy strumming.
Yeah. His name was Matthew, and then a third person called Matthew joined us, and
you could have formed the Matthews.
We did, and we had a theme song which Matthew White actually
Eminem
wrote.
Yes,
Eminem's and M's.
Which went a little like
Triple M.
We are the Matthews. We've come to entertain you. But then we got another member of the band who was called Stephen, and that just broke it. But we played instrumental versions of Beatles songs in three different keys.
Should have just called them Yoko.
Because we each had different easy play Beatles Lennon McCartney hits music books, one of which would be written for the piano, so all the songs would be in the key of C, so you only had to play the white notes. Another one would be in a different key for, you know, beginner guitarists, and another one would be in a different key for some arbitrary reason. So we're all playing the same song in three different keys, and we were none the wiser. Totally stupid.
Well, you just educated me. I didn't realise there was a difference. But
well, probably nobody wanted to listen to your music, though. That would have been the problem.
Oh, the Beatles, now. I'd love to hear them.
The Beatles was not tremendously cool in the early 80s, I have to say.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I noticed that too. I was mad on the Beatles. Well, I guess, I don't know how I got interested, but just around the 80s. Yeah, I became very interested in the Beatles just when John Lennon got shot.
Yeah.
I'd bought like the whole set, the complete set of records, only about 3 weeks before. And I was listening to all of these records and thinking, this stuff's absolutely fantastic. Bang. Oh.
Yeah.
They're never going to reform now.
Yeah.
Oh, it was more than that. It was, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can still remember sitting in front of the telly when the news came on and my mother with the vacuum cleaner in her hand saying, oh, isn't that a shame? That's like indelibly printed on my mind.
Yes, didn't she? Did she understated it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I actually ran through the house and told my mum, and she said, "Who?" No, I don't care if the Who dies.
Yes.
Yeah, isn't it sad, you know, like some, a lot of the most colourful characters in the world often end up getting wiped out for some reason or other, isn't it? It's so often the case.
Yeah, yeah, I always feel like I was born, because I was born in 1969, and I always feel like I was born at the end of an era, when, you know, that's sort of, seems to be what happened in sort of 69, 70. They all choked on their vomit and died of drug overdoses and stuff. Yeah, it kind of ended. And then I arrived.
Well, it was kind of the adolescence of Western civilization, wasn't it? The 60s and 70s.
Well, and as we know, adolescents like taking risks.
Yes.
Which brings me to a fascinating subject of Japan.
Oh, yes.
Did you notice that? Is that good?
That was a very good segue. I'm curious to see where you're going with this.
Well,
I don't know. That's as far as I've got. I was just going to say, which brings me to the interesting subject of Japan.
Oh, you were asking me before about my life in Japan. Trains. You know how I've been pushing the trains?
Yes.
Not physically, but...
No.
You might end up doing it physically.
Yes.
I hope not.
No, I wouldn't like that. But they are actually very easy to push physically. When I was a little kid coming up, getting away from the subject of Japan now, but when I would come up to Kos on holidays, there were these rail lines on top of the jetty, the wooden jetty that's there now that the fishermen used to use for...
They used to railways, a rail track.
Well, there was originally two cranes on there. And they were there for loading timber onto the ships.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know friends who used to climb up those cranes, walk to the end or clamber to the end of those horizontal long, what do you call it, bit at the top.
The
crane jump
bit
and,
of the
and,
crane,
yes. Yeah, and jump into the water from there.
Those jetty jumpers today, they're just not as hard as they were.
They have no idea.
They?
That's three times as high as the present jetty. Yeah, yeah, no. But in any case, that was the true jetty jumper.
As a counsellor, Rodney, I think it's your duty to introduce a somewhere for people to jump off the jetty three times as high as the current place, just to make Christmases in Coffs Harbour what they ought to be.
What they used to be.
What they used to be, yeah.
And then we should put those little rail tracks back on the jetty again so that little kiddies can have fun pushing the fishing trolleys.
Like you used to.
Like we used to do. That was so fun, you know. Risk death, you know, risk amputation of the limbs as you jump onto those... But I don't know if anybody ever was actually hurt, you know, pushing those trolleys around. But you get the kids who'd be, you know, switching the points, so you'd be changing the points while the trolley comes along, so that your mates who are pushing the trolley over there, the trolley goes the wrong direction.
I didn't realise it was. I'd seen an old black and white photograph of the railway tracks on the Coffs jetty, and I just thought, black and white photograph. That must have been like, you know, 200 years ago, you know, back in Neolithic times or something, you know, which isn't very old in England, where I come from.
Well, it's remarkable. We think of this present way of life as being so settled and stable, but it's all so amazingly recent, eh? Everything.
Yes, well, you know, here we are talking inside a box on someone's computer.
Uh-huh.
We're little people inside someone's computer right now, and that would have been quite alien to us.
Well, this is even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, 10 years ago? No, maybe 15 years ago. Yeah, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, 15 years ago.
But I mean, going back to the rail thing, I used to live in Bondi Junction in eastern Sydney, and we had some heavy rain one year, and it washed some of the asphalt off Oxford Street, revealing the old tram lines underneath. And you just think, people used to know how to do things, like having a light rail system that actually took people from some place where they wanted to go to another place they wanted to go. That seems to be terribly hard these days. We only seem to be capable of doing urban sprawl.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The reason I started talking about trains, when, you know, when you asked me about Japan, was because of
the bullet train.
Yeah, well, Japan's is really trains extraordinaire. They about 150 years ago now, or maybe even 300 years ago, they wiped out all of their forests, the whole lot, and that in turn decimated their rivers, their water supply. They were, you know, they couldn't feed themselves, all sorts of dramas, and they put in a, you know, reforestation, you know, laws that would make certain reforestation. And then in the beginning of the last century, in order to modernize, they figured out that connecting all the cities up with the train line, the Western invention, or kind of, would...
Scottish invention.
Yeah, okay.
Cornish. All right.
Yes, okay.
Cornish. You're going to claim that.
I'm claiming that one. Redruth. Go to Redruth. There's a statue of the guy there. I can't remember his name right now.
Stevenson? What? James Watt?
Surely Watt's light bulb.
Well, Stevenson is the one who got the rocket. He probably didn't invent it, but he was successful commercially, I'd say. The first commercially successful engine that could actually pull a set of carriages, probably.
The expression on my face for our listeners here is me trying to remember the name of the man who's a statue in Redruth Town Square. And it's not Henry Tringrouse. And Matthew's going to look it up now, aren't you, Matthew? Thank you.
Yes. The expression on my face is the expression of a man looking up something on Wikipedia.
You can just edit this bit out while we look this up.
The Tim Minor statue?
No.
Rory McGraw was born there.
That's the guy's name. I know it. I feel like an idiot as soon as I see it. There should be notable people. Isn't that a bit more?
Is this your hometown?
Well, yeah. I didn't actually live in a town, but I lived. I went to Cornwall College, and I used to swim at Carnbrae. And get athlete's foot there. Yeah, what kind of rubbish Wikipedia article is that? They haven't even got him. I know the guy.
This guy.
He also invented the firework that they he tied a piece of string to a firework and shot it out to rescue people from ships that were sinking.
Oh yeah, the flares kind of thing.
Well, no, not a flare. It's actually he'd shoot a piece of string out to a ship. So quite often Cornwall's renowned for the wreckers and ships getting wrecked and stuff. So a ship would be floundering off the rocks off Cornwall, and they'd shoot a rocket out with a piece of string attached.
Yeah, okay.
And they pull the string and get a rope and tie the rope around their mast and then hoist themselves back to the shore, because quite often they jump overboard and just drown. And didn't find the name?
No.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, no, anyway, I met my...
Any Cornish people listening now, that'll be my mother probably, can tell me the name of the guy who was involved in steam engines and such like in Cornwall. Who is a statue person in Redruth? And it's not Henry Tringrouse or Marconi, because he was Italian. But he did come spend a lot of time in Cornwall.
Alright, so the train is a Scottish invention.
Cut that whole bit out.
Or Cornish.
Cornish. Oh, no, we haven't resolved that yet.
No.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I mean, these are important. Important issues.
Give it to me just a sec. I'll have to settle this. Give me the computer. I'm going to just look that up. I do know the guy, and it's going to annoy me for the rest of the evening, and we can't move on. It's definitely not there, is it?
It's not Mick Fleetwood.
No, it's not Mick Fleetwood. Here's another thing. You like Fleetwood Mac as well, huh?
No, I can't stand Fleetwood.
You don't like them?
My personal theory of music is that, I think, are you a bit of a fan of prog rock, would you say?
Better explain prog rock.
Progressive rock, or a lot of the early 70s type things that followed on from the Beatles.
Traffic!
You just have to give me examples, like you mean Supertramp or something?
More your Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelins and things like that.
He's not Scottish.
No, I wasn't such a fillet fan of them, no.
Okay.
Although Pink Floyd, I think, is... Like, their latest stuff is very good.
Can I just stop this conversation right here? We have the Battle of the Giants here between Pink Floyd and the Beatles. This is a whole other podcast, I'm afraid. This could go on all night once you two get going.
Okay, so the important...
back to the trains.
Back to the trains.
Japan.
Richard Trevithick,
the well-known Cornish inventor.
Cornish inventor.
Who is underrated the world
over. Oh, that's the one, you found him?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Bill, congratulations.
Bill. Thank you.
Good man, I'll give you
took
a
me
shot.
Hours to...
Yeah, well done.
Wasn't my
Ruben?
Memory.
Yeah,
well, I was all day today, people have been saying, what are you going to talk about tonight? And I said, I was going to talk about the external memory or expanded memory. You asked me, you said, what's it about tonight? And I said, oh, it's about the expanded memory. And you went, what? What the fuck are you talking about? Well, you didn't say that, but you sounded a bit concerned, like I was going to start talking about something that no one understood. The expanded memory is, or external memory, is a book that's been recently published.
I thought you were talking about some computer program.
No, it's a series of essays by a bunch of psychologists.
Yeah.
Talking about how the human brain is not your mind. Your mind is processed by the brain, perhaps, but... It's contained in many discrete places, such as Wikipedia is just told me that I knew Richard Trevithick was the guy I was looking for there to do with the steam train, but I used my external mind, expanded mind, I went in Wikipedia.
Yeah, you're talking about the next step.
It's
a
little inefficient, I must admit.
No,
because
that's
right. It involved 10 minutes of chat before I found it.
The library you're talking about.
It's more than that. It's
the first step was the brain, and then they put it into a library.
Well, the example is that there's a man with Alzheimer's who's got short-term memory loss.
That's like me. Oh, no.
And he has a book he carries everywhere with him. And in this book, he keeps notes about, stuff.
Yeah, I need to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I have many different ways of keeping notes, and unfortunately, I forget which ones I'm using. And he might keep a note in there saying where the local theatre is, and then he discovers that there's a really good play on, next week at the theatre, and he really wants to see it. So he really gets his book and looks up where to go, and off he goes to see his show, and to find out that he forgot that it wasn't until next week. But, these are the problems. Whereas Olga, the woman who doesn't have any sort of Alzheimer's, she just finds that piece of information in the back of her brain and goes, yep, I know it's down the main street there and turn left, and she finds it. So they're both essentially doing the same thing, but one's using a book and one's using her brain because she's got the capacity in there to store that stuff. But maybe she hasn't. Maybe even, like in my case, I quite often think that I don't actually have the capacity, and I wish everyone would wear name badges, and that would be my external memory, But I just think it's an interesting theory, or an interesting idea.
Well, you're bringing up the idea of the discussion of names, remembering names there.
Yeah.
I have a few theories with that, because I have trouble remembering names, and I often find that if I don't know the person very well, it doesn't matter how hard I try, I can't remember their name. It's not until I actually know what their character is that then I can say, oh, this character, this concept, this construct, whatever it is, that's a Roger or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And as soon as I've got an idea what that person's like, then I have no trouble. I remember the name, that's fine. But if I don't know what the person's like, I just can't seem to keep attaching that name to that person.
I think you and I have exactly the same problem. I've had numerous embarrassing experiences where I've,
That's dreadful, isn't it?
That's only because you're so likable. If like me, you adopt the persona of a grouchy curmudgeon, nobody wants to come up to you and say, hi, how are you?
Hi, Matthew.
Yeah, I don't have that problem.
It's terrible when they come up to you and they know your name, don't they? And
people cross the road to avoid me, so I don't have to learn names.
I do have that problem though, where people, everyone seems to know my name, and I don't seem to know anybody's name.
Oh, well, I know your name.
I'm Matthew.
You seem to know my name.
That's Reuben.
Yeah, and I'm Bob. Bob the Builder.
Yeah, I'm just Bruce. We'll just call each other Bruce. We're all drinking wine here.
New Bruce.
It's a wonderful paint stripper, this one.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you about Japan if you.
Yeah, back to the trains in Japan. Okay, we've figured out.
No, just
got over the bullet trains in Japan. I'd love to know more about Japan.
Yeah, and when I first started living there, it's you know, coming from Coffs Harbour, this area, this is where I grew up and everything. It was all bush, basically. It was Thompson's Road where now the golf course is now. That was the edge of Coffs Harbour when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go riding on the mud flats, muddies, with an old bomb clapped out motor scooter or something like that with your mates. Now that was the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow or other I found myself living in Japan after I married.
Sorry, how did you find you were living in Japan?
Well, I met this lovely girl in Newcastle when I was doing my education course.
You got to watch out for those lovely girls.
Yeah, that
Newcastle.
Was the problem, wasn't it? Yeah. And
that's been my downfall too.
The compromise was to go to, you know, was to move over there, so...
Oh, she's Japanese.
She was Japanese, yeah.
So you were a souvenir?
I guess you could... Exactly.
Yeah, I'm a souvenir.
Exactly.
I was an Aussie backpacker, picked me up and took me home.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I wasn't stuffed when I got home. She thought I was just a, you know, someone put a mantelpiece, but it turned out I was actually a living, breathing pom. So yeah, she's been stuck with me ever since.
Ever since, yeah.
Poor girl.
Anyway, so I was a souvenir for a little while, and then I souvenired her.
Oh, that's
and
clever.
Brought her back here. Yeah, my interest in Japan is growing all the time, so I'd like to take a bit of a trip back there. We'll go back next year, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got plane tickets already booked for a 3-week stint. I'll go and visit all the sites that I never actually did visit when I was there, because, you know, when you live in a place, you can visit them any time, can't you?
So you don't.
But you don't.
Yes.
No. There was this open-air museum, which always intrigued me. We used to go past the sign. This was like an old ruin of a castle or something. Because there's, you know, many castles all over Japan. Most of them got burnt or bombed or something. So there was the ruin of this castle. And I always saw the sign going that way. And in all of the years that I was there, I never actually checked it out. So this time, it's written down.
It's one
of the things I'm going to do.
Life is short. You've got to seize the day and go and do
well,
these
the amount
things.
Of things, yeah, that's right. The amount of things I actually want to do when I go back, I don't know if we'll be able to fit them all in.
But 3 weeks is a very short time.
It is, yeah, because one little journey like just that is pretty much a day.
Mm.
So to go there and find it and...
Yeah, and there's a balance there, isn't it? You don't want to ruin your 3 weeks there by
becoming
rushing,
totally exhausted. That's right.
Rushing
yeah.
from place to place because you sort of.
Oh, there's funny things in Japan. You know, there was a cartoon called Crayon Shinchan, and crayon is like a crayon because it's drawn. It's an animated cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
Shinchan is just a naughty boy, and. The very first episode of this movie in Japan, the guy died. He fell off a mountain just about a year or 6 months ago.
Okay.
Quite catastrophic. The guy that who created this series was fairly quite big news in Japan about 6 months ago. But anyway, the first episode of this Crayon Shinchan, exactly what you're saying there. There's a holiday period in Japan called Golden Week. There's about 3 or 4 days in a row, public holidays all in a row. Everybody gets in their latest, you know, the family car, which is, you know, increasingly popular these days in Japan, you know, copying the West. There's another story there too. But anyway, they're all getting in the car, and of course, as soon as you get out of the driveway of your car, the first thing you do is you stop. You just queue up.
Yeah.
And this whole movie, this first movie, Crayon Shinchan, is about this little boy. He's such a naughty boy. He's in the back of this really tiny little, it's like, they called them light cars, and that was exactly the car that we had. Probably the same model. It looked pretty much the same.
I suppose in Australia, the equivalent would be a smart car.
Like a Daihatsu Mira or a Suzuki Swift? No.
Yes.
No,
no,
even smaller than that.
Those ones with the back cut off them. I'm curious about the animator. What was his name? Do you remember?
Oh, no, I don't know that.
He wasn't the Studio Ghibli guy. He's still alive, isn't he?
No.
The Disney of Japan? Or
yeah, no, it wasn't Studio Ghibli, no. No, they're a classic set
of...
You've heard of that guy? Is he the guy who does the squirrel with enormous testicles?
That's the one, yeah. The big, big nutted rodent. Yeah.
I don't know about that one.
You're interested in Japanese culture and you don't know about that one? What's it called? Pocahontas? No, that's
Pokemon. No,
Just Look it up, Matthew. And
the squirrel with the big testicles.
It's a hilarious, absolutely fantastic.
I know all of the Ghibli movies, but I don't know of the squirrel with the...
It's not a squirrel. It's a... And it's about trees being chopped down. You'd be interested in this one.
If it's not a squirrel, what is it?
It's I don't know what it is. What are those things?
I can't just Google Japanese testicles. That's not going to work.
You better write. What's his name?
Ghibli. Just Ghibli. Ghibli will do. Ghibli. There'll be some. There's so many fan sites.
Miyazaki.
Pompoko. There you go. Pompoko. It's very eye-opening movie because they actually parachute using nothing but their nutsacks.
Oh, okay. Now this isn't Miyazaki Hayao. Oh no, that's okay.
He's done the name some movies.
The ones I'm thinking about, Princess Spirited Away.
Princess Mononoke. Same guy.
Yeah, Princess Mononoke.
I'm sure.
You think so?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Pompoko. According to IMDb, is translated as the
Hayao Miyazaki.
I see. He's a writer, but he's not a director.
A community of magical sheep.
Yeah, that's right. Miyazaki.
Raccoons. They're not squirrels. They're raccoons, and they've got parachuting testicles.
All right, that's good. Check that one out.
You should check that one out. You might get some tips if you're ever in an air crash or anything.
まもなく2番線に渋谷新宿方面行きが参ります。危ないですから黄色い線までお下がりください。
はい、2番線ご注意ください。2番線渋谷新宿方面行きが到着です。
The area that I lived in, Kyushu, had an image of being rough within Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually famous for having lots of yakuza there.
Yakuza. It's obviously wrong.
The Japanese mafia. And we actually lived in a yakuza house, would you believe?
Really?
It had...
That explains why you're a counsellor.
Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah, it does,
doesn't
it?
Yeah.
Yakuza, I don't counselor. Know of any yakuza or... Well, we won't go there. My wife's uncle, through, I don't know how it happened, he started gambling big time and lost all of their family's wealth. They were fairly...
We have pokey problems in Australia, so we're used to that.
Yeah, well, this was playing cards, a game called Hanafuda, which you can... that there are... these gambling places in Japan, the top floor, which is a no-go zone ordinarily for any for you and I, but for those of us who are going to get into that sort of thing, you can go up to the top floor and you can start playing these cards, and that's what he must have done and lost the lot. And in Japan, when you end up with a massive big debt, you don't just say, oh I'm sorry. Oops. You know,
here's my house.
No, you don't. You don't say that. You bolt, because they'll be after you and they'll slit your throat. You know? And so eventually the yakuza got involved. Well, it's all yakuza anyway. And I don't know exactly how the story unfolded, but eventually that house where my uncle, his house, was occupied by a yakuza group, and they bulletproofed the windows. So there was bulletproof glass on all the windows. There was a concrete barricade right around the house, which was about a metre thick.
No paper walls for you in Japan.
Oh, inside there were. And it had a second floor, and up on top there was six bunks. So the members of that particular yakuza outfit, they were all bunked down on that top floor. There were six bunks there. And on any of the windows, you had all of these signs written in Japanese, like, if you leave this window open, I will kill you. You know, all these lovely little signs plastered around the house. And it was really good. There were some little slits poking out a gun, maybe. Yeah. It was really, it's quite exciting. And we lived in that place for about a year. And none of the neighbours would, or locals would, rent that house because it had been touched by the yuk. They're all, you know, absolutely scared. This was a yuk's house, and they were looking for someone to perhaps live in it and, you know, make it, you know, bring it back into the...
Cleanse it a bit.
Yeah, cleanse it a little bit. That was what we did. So we lived there for about a year and a half. And
you didn't get killed?
We took the nostalgia away, yeah.
Yeah.
Took that reputation away and...
Yes, I read a story about the Yakuza years ago, actually, and that was very disturbing.
Yeah. I don't know how it'll go now, but for a while the Yakuza were kind of assimilating to Japanese society a little bit. Still not, you know, completely kosher, but they were, because things were going well, they could start to see a way that they could mesh into society and was semi-legal. That wasn't, wasn't all the drugs or brothels or gambling houses or whatever that they were running. There was a bit for in the late 80s.
That was my phone, excuse me.
That's a Pink Panther, that's Monty Python-ish too.
Hello. Hello, how you doing? Oh, is it late, is it? What time is it?
This is the sound of somebody
in
trouble.
You go to bed, I'll be alright. You can hear the yawning from there, can you?
Yeah, I promised my wife that I would be back by 9:32.
Oh, probably 10:30-ish.
Yeah, we should do this again in about a week's time.
I'm not sure.
My wife will go to HSC Martin.
Oh, Rodney, is your mum called Becky?
Pat.
No, she's called Pat. Not the same. Are you related to anyone called Becky?
Not that
I know. The works at the uni.
Yeah, you know her too.
I know Becky.
Knows Becky. Becky.
What's her last name?
Deegan.
Oh, without
the S. Without the S, yeah.
Oh, hang on, it's spelt wrong. It's spelt wrong. It's Rodney is D-E-G-E-N.
S.
S. But so does Becky, but she's got an A in there as well.
But she doesn't have the S on the end.
Yeah. Well, look, we have another glass of wine to go yet, so that's probably another, 20 minutes or so. Half an hour. You go to bed. I won't wake you up. This is all on tape, isn't it? You'll edit that out though, won't you?
I will.
You promise?
Yeah.
Well, I've got to ring mine too, I think.
Yeah, Rodney's ringing his wife too, so... You know, I think you'll find this podcast interesting.
Moshi moshi. Ato 30
pun
gurai.
Well, I'll let you go then, and I'll be home soon. Ish.
Ah, もう買い物ができてるよ.
Okay.
もう買い物した.
Yeah, shut down the computer. I'm not going to use it.
Yeah, of course. No, I will.
She sent me a text message.
ごめんね.
What'd she say?
バカなし. But she didn't mind too much.
I feel really guilty. I feel like I'm the, as well
You're
as being,
bad man,
as well
you?
As being the only
You're
person in Coffs Harbour without a chicken, I'm the principal cause of marital strife in Coffs Harbour.
No.
You like to think.
No, it's.
You're like Hugh Hefner.
Hugh Hefner didn't have chickens either.
Grab yourself a sachet of yeast. And a bag of flour. And a bag of flour. You stick your finger in, you shouldn't feel it. You stick your finger in. This is going somewhere, I'm not sure.
Our audience is ready to go.
This is going somewhere, I'm not sure.
Our audience is ready to go.
Pull it back over itself, push it down again.
And then you swivel it around and turn it. You push it down.
Put it somewhere warm, like your cat or something. Which brings me back to trains. No, Japan.
No,
we've done all those.
No. Can't remember what they were now. There's a whole lot of bits, odds and ends. Police.
Police?
Yeah, that was one. It was interesting.
It was a hook?
Well, Yeah, people are all complaining that there's not enough police, that's what you said.
Yes, yeah, there was, I remember the advocate likes to have a whinge now and again about, I basically, what Coffs Harbourites are whinging about on what the advocate's whinging about, because, I don't know.
It's not so much that there's not enough police, it's what the police are allowed to do, which is probably the problem. I'm not saying that they need to lock everybody up, but there's limitations on what they can do, and some of the things that they can do perhaps may not be that bad. We just have to get our creative juices flowing and see what we can, what other potential actions or ideas or methodology, that they can put into practice are. I know I went down to the local government conference in Albury last weekend, and there's a police campaign at the moment where they want to simply reduce the opening hours of different pubs and what have you around the state. And it all depends on which particular town you're talking about, and each one is looked on case by case, but fairly simple thing, just maybe chopping off an hour or an hour and a half or something for targeted places, and it makes quite a difference. And then,
so how does it work at the moment? Can for instance Sawtell Pub, they have a license to open certain hours and they can just open those hours if they want to, or?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then what the police are proposing is that they can then say to the pub, no, actually you can't open those hours, you have to open the hours we say.
You have to say one, close an hour earlier than you normally would shut. So it means that last hour where people might, load up with those last few drinks, which take them beyond the point of, really no return, you take that away from them. And so while they're still, able to...
So you mean Matthew and I have to get to the pub earlier now to load up and drink?
Exactly right. So, but the thing is, you educated types, you might read the paper and realise that there's an earlier closing time, but we're being a bit...
hopefully the uneducated types aren't listening to this podcast because they'll soon discover
edit this out too, aren't we?
might be a good idea.
The problem that I had when I first moved up here, did I whinge about this on an earlier podcast?
I'll stop you if you have.
Okay. When we first moved up here, because we moved on short notice, we'd chosen Sawtell as the place we wanted to live, but because we had like a fortnight's notice to move, we ended up renting for the first year in Boambi East, believing the real estate agent's claims that it's just minutes away from the shops and cafes and beaches of Sawtell. It's just minutes away if you happen to have a helicopter, but other than that, it's couple of hours.
Where
walk.
Was it?
Boambi East, up in the hills.
Oh, that's minutes away. Yeah, by car.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're already in it.
Yeah, at the time I didn't have a driver's license. So I nearly went completely barking mad, because the only thing within walking distance of a house in Boambi East is other houses in Boambi East.
Sad, isn't it?
There is nothing else. And so I was used to going to the pub on the way home from work.
Yeah.
And so I'd finish work for the day, because...
Don't you think walking around the beautiful Australian suburbia is just absolutely so monotonous.
It is soul destroying.
Yes.
And when I first moved up here, I would finish work for the day, have my dinner, and think, right, I'm going to go to the nearest pub, which was the Taormina Hotel, which was like 40 minutes walk away.
Uh-huh.
And by the time I got there, they'd be stacking the chairs up on the tables, because their principal clientele is tradies who knock off at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had it explained to me several times by the staff there, look, this is a public service, the fact that we close at 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening. Because if we didn't, there'd be all these people getting crazy drunk who've been here since 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But I don't follow that logic at all. If there's no pub within walking distance, or if the pub that's there closes, you're going to be left drinking cask wine and going out of your head with loneliness.
Mm. Oh, but we don't have to actually put up with them staggering home and, you know, screaming outside because they're desperately sad and lonely. They could just do it at home.
If there's no problem, if there's no one, you know, becoming violently drunk, smashing up the neighbourhood, then there's no problem. It's only when you've got people complaining that their windows are being smashed and their children are being bashed, you know, all that sort of thing, that's when you need to do something.
Well, my personal theory is that from a harm minimisation point of view, drinking in the pub should be cheaper than drinking at home, simply because being in a public place forces you to behave in a more civilised way.
No, and
you can't go crazy drunk.
I mean, that might be the case for you, but I think a lot of people will go get crazy drunk.
Oh.
They'll be looking for fights.
I don't know.
I attended that rally in Park Beach the other day, other week. Pretty upset bunch of local residents were attending that meeting. And I mean, you could see them, they were at the end of their tether. And
what rally was this, sorry?
The residents around Park Beach area, particularly hotel owners or business owners around there, they're saying that their businesses are under threat because there's a reputation for, you know, violence. And
that's true, actually.
I think that's largely because the culture we have in Australia around drinking is based around binge drinking rather than you know, drinking a little bit too much.
Well, actually, which
a
is
lot
what,
too often.
Which is what we're doing this evening. We're not binge drinking tonight. We're having a couple of glasses of wine and a chat.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean,
there's nobody breaking anything here.
You know, David Byrne gave a very interesting talk at one of these TED conferences, saying that the architecture of a venue determines the kind of music that you can play in it. And this comes back to my love of pubs and the fact that you should get rid of all the pogies out of them and have live entertainment. Because in a small room, you can play a certain kind of music that is intimate and sort of up close and fast,
like that.
And it really connects with people.
But
if you're in a stadium, the acoustics of the place is such that you can't play fast music because the waves bouncing back off the stadium interfere with the waves coming out. So the only thing you can play are these really slow anthemic dirges.
I knew you were going to use that word.
Which is where your Pink Floyds and your U2s and whoever come into it. The music is, to me, it's dull. It's elevator music.
Yeah, the best concerts I've ever been to. Not that I've been to a lot of concerts, but the best concert is a word I wouldn't use to describe them. It would be a gig. Best gigs would have been in the Skittle Alley in the Blue Anchor when I was 15 or 16. The Blue Anchor was my local pub, and they had a room about the same size as this room. And there'd be a stage right there, and about 500 people crowded around it.
Mm. Would you believe?
And the whole pub was a mosh pit. It was fantastic. You know, we used to have a really great time there. And you know, I've been to lots of gigs since.
Yeah, no, I'd like to see live music or live acts, what you're talking about. It's nice, isn't it? But people don't seem to be interested in that these days.
It's very hard because, well, pub owners are stingy, and the amount of money that poker machines can pull in for pub owners is insane compared to the amount of money that attracting a couple of extra drinkers is going to do from having a band play.
Well, pubs used to be about making money from selling alcohol, and now they make money from gambling.
From idiots.
You're gonna edit that out too, aren't you?
No, I'm not gonna.
Matthew's doing the editing. This is the problem, you see. He'll leave all his favourite bits in. we're at his mercy.
But going back to the Beatles, it's hard to believe it, but the Beatles used to play lunchtime gigs in Liverpool. People would go out for lunch and listen to a band play at a local venue. And you're really pushing it to get a band on at the Sawtelle Hotel twice a week.
Yeah, it was a different world though, because that rock and roll music was coming into its age, wasn't it? Mm. It's exciting. It's a lot of these things, like everything has its, that goes through a cycle to reach its peak, and it's those formative years where things are so exciting. So these days, a lot of all of these things have gone. They're on the down side of the curve. Even like movies these days, I think they're don't you think so? Like movies.
Oh, movies are dreadful.
Yeah, they're going down. Like it's all, and then the internet is sort of taking up where movies are leaving off.
I think watching funny kissing movies is far more amusing than anything else.
It's funny kissing?
Funny kissing movies. Yeah. Cats doing funny, amusing things.
If you can't get over a 1 centimetre gap in the pavement, then you're not going to get out to the footpath in order to encounter difficulty with that footpath. It's just pure legal arse covering on the part of the councils, who are scared of someone saying, well, I tripped over and it was the council's fault.
Well, you could always have just a little dirt track on the side.
The jetty strip in Coffs Harbour, the opposite side of it doesn't have a footpath at all.
Oh, yes.
And that's, one of the major pedestrian areas in Coffs. And there is no footpath, full stop. There is a footpath, but it's way up at the top of the hill there. Yes, so no problem at all with having no footpath, full stop. But if you've got a footpath, then that becomes a liability. So there's a disincentive to putting footpaths in from the point of view of the council.
Yeah, that's right. No, there's lots of... When I first moved to Japan, you would go out into the street and there would be these... I reckon they would have been 80 years old, but maybe 70-year-old grandmothers on top of bicycles, just riding straight bang in the middle of the street. And the cars would be stopping and waiting for them to go wherever it is they're going to go, and riding around them. The thing is that you don't have a footpath, because it's not necessary. You've got a street, that's the footpath, and everybody uses the street. And this idea that you have to have a separate footpath for cyclists and then another one for the road, it's just one step too far, isn't it? The dominance of the motor vehicle is some kind of insanity that we have.
I think we need a Coffs Harbour reclaim the streets.
Yes, that's exactly right. And in fact, the history of it all is that there was quite a bit of work done by the automobile industry to take the streets away from the ordinary people in the streets.
It ruins their image when they flatten people, doesn't it?
That's right. Well, no, they're not allowed to sell their cars if the automobile does not have access to the streets, then they can't sell their cars. And that was where the concept of the playground, the little kiddies park.
Yeah.
You have a little suburban district, and somewhere in there you have a set little kiddies park where the kiddies can play.
Mm.
No. Kid, I would never have made the formal effort of walking to the park and then playing in the park. I never would have done that. I would
the
have
best fun I ever had was playing football in the streets.
Exactly. Mm. Or running down the hill in your big billy cart and playing chicken to see if you could get around that corner without being flattened by a semi-trailer.
My brother built this fabulous goat. We used to live in a place called Lower Town, which was, as the name implies, a lower town. It was in a valley, and it had a wonderful hill going all the way down one side and a wonderful hill up the other side. And my brother built a go-kart which was probably about 5 feet wide. And the reason he built it so wide was
he wanted to take the corners.
He wanted to slide around those corners at, 60 miles an hour, laying head first, face down.
That's exactly what I did.
Oh,
I had
the
terrific accident. But anyway.
I was chasing him down in my rally arena, my equivalent to a Malvern Star, bicycle. And I was racing down Lower Town Hill, following my brother on the go-kart. And I remember I must have hit, 30 miles an hour, going as fast as I possibly could, trying to catch him. I just lost him. He had no brakes on this thing, He took off down this hill. And I remember coming around this corner, I was leaning around, my knees were scraping the ground as I was going around the corner. And there was a car coming around the corner, going up the hill. And I thought, oh my God, he's dead. And somehow he'd managed to, go under the car or avoid the car somehow. And I eventually got to the bottom of the hill and he still wasn't there. And I thought, maybe he went over the hedge or something. I didn't know where he was. And it turned out he'd actually gone halfway up the other side of the hill.
Speed.
And this is the fun we used to have as kids. Despite the cars, kids will just go and play wherever they have to play.
Yeah, I know that where I was living, it was in Wollongong, there was this really steep hill, and where it would get down to, at the bottom where it met the next street, was a T-intersection, and that you had to turn right there. There was no follow-through after the hill. This is just crazy, to get to the top of this hill and go down it, and then you've got to do something when you get to the bottom there, but that was what we did.
You worry about it when you get there.
Yeah. You worry about it, and then what you do is, after you pick yourself up off the ground and there's no skin left on any joint, you spend the next 3 weeks, just trying to make sure you stop the bleeding and that.
Yeah, I remember my little brother Joe going down Lower Town Hill on a scooter, and at the bottom of the hill there was a bridge going over the river, and he went straight off the bridge into the river. And I sort of arrived a few seconds later on a bicycle, again chasing him, because I tended to follow these mad brothers who went too fast, and I'd go down on a bicycle rather tentatively after them. And I remember pulling him out of the river, and I couldn't quite believe he was still alive. And he had a big lump on his forehead, and it was very unnatural. And I, my God, you've really smacked your head there. It's a big lump coming up. And it doesn't hurt. Well, it should do. It's a huge lump. And he went up to feel it. And as he touched it, it turned out there was a big pebble embedded under his skin, because he'd hit his head so hard on the riverbed, this stone had just gone bloop, straight inside the skin.
Oh.
And when he touched it, it just kind of popped out, and he had this little stone in his hand. And I remember he kept that stone for a long time. I think he took it up the hill with him to show my mum. He said, I just found this in my head.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, it all just... all of these similar scenarios.
But, we're not mentioning the many brothers we lost during our childhood. The ones that fell down mine shafts and, set themselves on fire on scooters.
Well, I know that my brother, he had a piece of brass stuck inside, it's just like what you're talking about with
the rock.
Piece of brass stuck inside his leg, which festered for 20 years. 20 years, and he dug it out with knitting needle or something. Some subtle instrument like that.
Oh, there's that piece of brass I lost.
Yeah, he pulled it out, and the piece of brass was, was about, what was that, 5 millimetres long, 3 millimetres in diameter, but it was from some... They were playing with a bullet or something, and they were smashing it, and the thing went, and it got stuck, and there was this. So for 20 years, he had this piece of material sitting inside his leg, and then.
Yeah, my dad caught me once with a bullet in a vise, and I had a hammer and a nail, and I was hitting it, And he came in and went, "What are you doing?" I'm just trying to hit something. And he didn't actually see what I had in the vise. And I remember I got away with it. He didn't catch me. But
so then, where did you get the bullet from?
Oh, my dad's gun.
You know? Oh, he had a gun. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, he had guns, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, we were crazy gun nuts. Now, actually, there's no such thing as crazy gun nuts in England. No, we had guns to shoot
just
rabbits with.
Yeah, we have gum nuts in Australia.
No, we just shot rabbits occasionally. We were farmers in England.
Oh. Ah.
Not in the same way as Australian farmers, I suppose, because Australian farmers would just call it a garden, you know, or a backyard.
Yeah.
You know, we had 90 acres. So.
My father, going through World War II and everything, he had a like an obsessive kind of a hate for guns.
Mm-hmm.
So we never, he still does. So
my dad's always been very paranoid about guns. I was never allowed anywhere near the gun, which is why I was so fascinated by them and managed to steal the bullets and try and set them off with a hammer and nail.
Yeah, no, I never played with a bullet.
Quite glad I didn't set it off.
Mm.
But your brother did.
Yeah, my brother did. And in fact, he pulled it out just because I was living in Sydney and I came up and on holidays and was just visiting him, and then while he was sitting there, you know, chatting away in a lounge, he was sitting there picking away on this thing, and now they got to come. And there was this piece of brass that's been in there for 20 years. I remember the story when it happened because, blood everywhere and stitches and all that. So 20 years later, conclusion to the story.
Yeah, it's nice to know it came out in the end.
I did. All the stupid things.
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to I want to come and see your boat sometime.
Well, yeah, give it about a month, I reckon it's going to float. It's amazing,
What's left to do on it?
Basically another coat of paint, sprayed it with two-pack paint,
mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Not sprayed it, rolled it,
because
I've read on the...
And now you've got to sand it all down again?
Just a little bit. I've really lost all interest in perfect jobs, you know.
Oh, there's a damn fucker floats.
That's pretty much the size of it. That's right. So, it's called a Farrier. The name of the boat, it's a Farrier. If you look it up on the...
Farrier.
The actual boat's called an F-82. 8.2 metres. Mine's probably about 8.5 and a bit longer. And state-of-the-art trimaran they are. Capable of 20 knots, which is like 40 k's.
State of the art 10 years ago,
but even now the same model is there.
Mm-hmm.
The only improvements that he's made is really the mechanisms for folding. And
who's the designer?
Oh, his name is Farrier, Ian Farrier.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the actual shape of the hull, which is what determines how well it goes, that hasn't changed. That's already reached its perfect shape. It looks like a dolphin, basically. It's an organic sort of a shape.
Okay.
Yeah, it's quite a special thing.
Sorry, Matthew, you're sitting there rolling your eyes.
You know a guy called Noam Chomsky?
Yeah, I know Noam Chomsky.
He's one of my heroes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, I wrote him a letter and he answered it. And
He doesn't answer emails, but he will answer letters
occasionally.
Yeah.
Yeah, he must be getting a little bit more elderly now.
His wife died last year, which was a severe blow, I would imagine, because she's been sort of silently supporting him for since the '50s. He's still going strong.
Yeah. Well, anyway, 10 years ago when I started this thing, I took a black and white photograph and developed it myself. And then I put that in a letter and sent it to him. Because I know he's interested in boats.
Oh, mm-hmm. I didn't know he was interested in boats.
Yeah, he's interested in sailing. Mm. And so he...
Sailing is much like bicycles in the water, really, isn't it? I mean, it's a self-powered kind of...
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah. Oh, there he is.
There's much excited talk these days about a great global shift of power, with speculation about whether or when China might displace the US as the dominant global power, along with India, which, if it happened, it would mean that the global system would be returning to something like what it was before the European conquests. And indeed, their GDP growth has been spectacular. But there's a lot more to say about it. So if you take a look at the UN Human Development Index, basic measure of the health of a society, it turns out that India retains its place near the bottom. It's now 134th, slightly above Cambodia, below Laos and Tajikistan. Actually, it's dropped since the reforms began. China ranks 92nd, a bit above Jordan, and below the Dominican Republic and Iran. By comparison, Cuba, which has been under harsh U.S. attack for 50 years, is ranked 52nd. It's the highest in Central America and the Caribbean, barely below the richest societies in South America. India and China also suffer from extremely high inequality, so well over a billion of their inhabitants fall far lower in the scale. Furthermore, an accurate accounting would go beyond conventional measures to include serious costs that China and India can't ignore for long, ecological resource depletion, many others.
So that's from May this year.
I haven't seen him for a long time, so he does look aged, yeah.
These common speculations about a global shift of power, which you can read all over the front pages, disregard a crucial factor that's familiar to all of us. Nations divorced from the internal distribution of power are not the real actors in international affairs. That truism was brought to public attention by that incorrigible radical Adam Smith, who recognized that the principal architects of power in England were the owners of the society, in his day the merchants and manufacturers, and they made sure that policy would attend scrupulously to their interests, however grievous the impact on the people of England, and of course much worse the victims of what he called the savage injustice of the Europeans abroad. British crimes in India were the main concern of an old-fashioned conservative with moral values. To his modern worshippers, Smith's truisms are ridiculed as, quote, elaborate theories of how world history was being manipulated by shadowy corporatist imperialist networks. I'm quoting New York Times thinker David Brooks. It's one of the many illustrations of the intellectual and moral decline of what's called conservatism from the understanding of its heroes. Actually, in the interests of full disclosure, I should mention that I'm identified as the villain who adopts Adam Smith's heresy, as in fact I do. Well, bearing Smith's radical truism in mind, we can see that there is indeed a global shift of power, though not the one that occupies center stage. It's a shift from the global workforce to transnational capital, and it's been sharply escalating during the neoliberal years. The cost is substantial, including the Joe Stacks of the U.S., starving peasants in India, millions of protesting workers in China, where the labor share and income is declining even more rapidly than in most of the world.
Yeah, I think he's very good, but I don't think you can really accept everything that he says. I think you have to judge it critically, like everything that you should.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an enormous amount of value in what he says, though. But the thing is, he's into a lot of detail.
Yeah.
And if you get caught in the detail, you can often lose sight of bigger events which are floating around governing the whole series of events. And just blaming certain, you know, sides, taking sides on this or that. It's like he spent a lot of time speaking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's got some Jewish background himself and spent a bit of time in all of those things. He's
and
he does look at both sides of the equation, but I think he's well, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, I know the US has been a very naughty boy in the middle. You've got hours of conversation, really.
Oh, I was just listening to this thinking, my God, we've got another podcast to go here, because I could talk about the Middle East till the cows come home.
Oh, because Reuben worked on a kibbutz in Israel for...
Well, only for a short time, but I did live in Israel for 8 months during the Gulf War, and that was very enlightening for me, or in heavying.
You were there during the Gulf War?
For the first Gulf War, yeah.
All right, gee.
And that was extremely interesting, just because I was not politically aware of anything, really.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from hating Maggie Thatcher because of what she did to England, and then I left England and to escape from this fucking dump and went to a military base known as Israel. And I thought Israel was this wonderful hippie commune place, you know, with kibbutzes where everyone was equal and it was all...
That's exactly what Vietnam
And when I got there, I realised that wasn't the case. It was just a big military base, and the entire country, every single person in the country is a member of the armed forces, whether they like it or not.
Mm.
And most of them are quite happy
with it. Well, that's the only reason it's there. England needed a base there.
Balfour Beatty contract, the drawing those lines on the map and there's Israel, you know.
Yeah.
And
the Jewish situation in World War II was simply a good excuse to do it.
Making something good out of something bad.
Yeah, that's right.
English, so.
And the rest of the Middle East understands that. They know that all too well. And it's just another reason why they are very displeased.
Oh, and just seeing the massive lies that were portrayed during the Gulf War. I was in Eilat at the beginning of the Gulf War, and I remember George Bush, senior, talking about how restrained Israel was during the war, and you know, it's wonderful that Israel's not getting involved, and there was lots of rhetoric about Israel not getting involved and Israel not getting involved and Israel not responding to these provocations from Saddam, and Saddam's sending Scud missile after Scud missile. And these Scud missiles were like worn-out double-decker buses, chugging their way over with lawnmower engines. They were piles of shit flying in. By the time they arrived in Israel, they had an explosive about the size of a firecracker, you know. And they inevitably missed everything. You know, these missiles would just chug along and land in the Mediterranean, or, you know, maybe hit something occasionally. There was very few fatalities. But, all this talk about Israel not being involved was a lie. I was in Israel and I saw the Israeli jet fighters taking off, flying to Saudi Arabia every single day, several times a day.
Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, they fly to Saudi Arabia where they refuel and then fly in from Saudi Arabia so that they're not identifiable as Israeli jets.
Oh, yes.
But anyone in Israel, because they're flying over Eilat, which goes straight down through the Red Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in Israel, you're going, well, yeah, it's our boys. But, you know, you're Israeli, you don't mind. Most people who weren't Israeli weren't in the country. I was in a backpacker hostel with maybe 8 other backpackers. And before that, there was probably 100 backpackers in Eilat. But they all emptied out before the war. And I only stayed there because I didn't want to go back to England. And the rest of the people in the hostel were probably army deserters. Pretty sure they were, but I knew.
The first Iraq war is interesting, isn't it? The only reason that Saddam wanted to annex Kuwait was because they were, I mean, all these oil wheels, they don't really care about the boundaries, do they? So, yeah, you start pumping out oil, which is, say, the Kuwaitis, but maybe there's a little bit of your oil well on the Kuwaiti side, the rest of it's on the Iraqi side, but they're
pumping it all out.
Yeah, and that upset Saddam a little.
If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is, that's a straw, you see. Watch it. And my straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
And so he goes and does something about it. But
and normally who would give a shit, you know? I mean,
no, and Saddam thought that America didn't really care if he went and did something about it, but and then he did something, and he only meant to just word them up a little bit, and then they were running out of Iraq as it was, and but America for some reason had some agenda that they wanted to go and fix him up before he got out of Kuwait and make it look that they were the ones and who were
solving. I don't know about anyone else, but I for one was really fucking shocked by the recent news headlines when Gillard was talking about how we're going to be in Afghanistan for another, 10 years?
Well, this is the same thing I keep 2012. Asking people. I never get an answer. I really can't quite figure out what is so important about Afghanistan. Why have had so many people in there for so long, blasting away there? Like, I get some stories like it's a stop Russia. It's some sort of a little gateway for...
It doesn't seem to be any reasonable excuse
to me. I mean, they talk about oil pipelines from...
John Pilger has always said it's always been about the oil pipeline from the Caspian Sea, but I don't know. There's a book by an investigative journalist whose name temporarily escapes me, where he says the motivation for the second Iraq War, the Pentagon and the State Department both had different conflicting reasons for wanting to invade Iraq. One side wanted to get Saddam out of the picture so that they could destabilize OPEC. The other side wanted to get Saddam out of the picture so that they could stabilize OPEC. Dick Cheney supported both these plans, despite the fact that they were contradictory. And
because he obviously had something to gain from both.
I think the reason why is because Dick Cheney's career in government started during the Nixon administration, and he really seriously believes what Nixon said during the Frost interviews, that if the president does something, it's not illegal. And really what he wanted to do was establish the precedent that the executive branch of government in the US can do anything they jolly well like.
But I think
I think Obama has cemented that by pretending to pull out of Iraq and by you know, increasing the commitment to Afghanistan. It's basically saying, look, I'm the president of the US and whatever I want to do, I can do.
And then I reckon the question is, what would you do if you were in that position? Would you, because see, you've got all of the Western countries which sort of depend on the American dollar, that includes us too, going through the Great Depression, maybe you're right, you know? We've got to face reality sometime, haven't we, that we've got to live without oil and live in a more sustainable way. But
yeah, but do we bite the bullet and all suffer and make ourselves stop using so much power and start sticking wind turbines on our house, or do we do it more slowly and invade Afghanistan and keep control of the oil over there and just take a bit more time over it?
Virtually everybody's job is dependent on oil coming out of the Middle East at this moment in time. So if you did it in a rush, there's going to be a lot of hungry people.
Mm.
How do you make that transition? I mean, we could make the transition, I think, but it's better to do these things gradually, isn't it?
I don't know if there's any politicians out there brave enough to make that choice for everyone.
Yeah, well, they weren't, were they? So
no,
therefore, we invaded Iraq.
Yeah. Well, I think we ran out of things to talk about. Well, I'm sure we could talk endlessly, but I just think that this is a whole other program.
I think we've run out of time rather than run out of things to talk about.
I think we're
increasing the range of things
talking about. This is not a podcast anymore. This is actually a pub conversation. Maybe it's next week. We'll be right back.
return you fall down. Raining days will be wasted over time. Let it waste, just betray.
We're surely done now. Have we talked enough yet? Can we go home now?